Earthquake swarms, Yellowstone. They've slowed down a little bit, but scientists are still baffled. In a moment, geologist Jim Berkland, later on tonight, will take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you listen to Coast on a regular basis, no major introduction necessary here with Jim Berkland, the geologist. But if you're brand new to the program, he was suspended from a California government geology job when he made a prediction that a major earthquake would occur during the 1989 World Series in the Oakland Bay Area. He was right. The government said, no more predictions, Jim. So he said, I'm retiring. And here he is. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Well, pretty good.
Man, you hit the other one. You hit December right on the head, my friend.
Well, it was quite a window with the highest tidal force since 1993. And it's not too far away from that, which is coming up between the 8th and the 15th of this month.
Let's concentrate, if we can, on this caldera, the supervolcano at Yellowstone. More than 500 earthquake swarms as of last Friday, so it could be even higher now, Jim. It's slowed down a little bit. The highest magnitude on the Richter scale, 3.5. Nonetheless, scientists say, you know what, there's a lot of activity here. What's your overall take on Yellowstone?
Well, volcanic areas frequently get earthquake swarms. And it's usually not something to get too excited about unless there are a lot of extra factors that go along with it. You get a shallowing of the earthquakes, gradually getting closer and closer to the surface. You get gases increasing with SO2 gases overtaking the H2S, our rotten egg smell. And with the special instruments measuring heat flow increasing, you get especially the harmonic tremors. These are earthquakes that don't really have a P wave initially.
And what is that? Yeah, tell us.
Well, that's the primary wave that arrives. If it's fairly close to you, it feels like a truck hitting your house, and it's the faster wave. It's like a sound wave in the ground. And then the slower wave, which is a little more than half as fast, then arrives, and that's the S wave, secondary wave, and that's the one that makes you feel a little seasick, and that's the one that does the damage. And so the further away the epicenter, the greater the separation of the two waves, just like thunder and, or call it lightning and thunder. You have, you get that lightning, and then within, if it's a mile away, it's about 5 seconds later that you get the sound. And with the P and the S wave of earthquakes, if it's 5 seconds difference between the P wave and the S wave arrival, it's about 25 miles away. And if it's 10 seconds, it's 50 miles away, and so forth. And so if you're right on top of the fault, the initial shake, well, you get the waves right together. So you get an idea right away how far away the earthquake was from your house.
Now, they say this one's overdue. It blew 640,000 years ago, and it's overdue. What does that exactly mean?
Well, it's a guess, because nobody knows for sure. You do have to have these preliminary symptoms, and the swarms come and go. Sometimes they can be meaningful, like with before Mount St. Helens. I was being interviewed by a Boston television station. I was up on the mountain waving my arms over the Calaveras Fault. They were doing a program called The Invisible Earthquakes and Volcanoes. And after we talked about the expected earthquake on the Calaveras Fault, they folded up their camera and they said, Jim, speaking of other things, what do you think about Mount St. Helens? And having known that we had just had a week earlier a 4.6 earthquake right under Mount St. Helens and a series of smaller earthquakes, I said, I think that volcano means business. I'd give it a 50-50 chance to erupt this year, which was 1980. And they said, well, I hope so. We're going to go fly around it this afternoon. And then when they dropped me off at the office after my noontime interview, my cohort said, Jim, did you hear Mount St. Helens started to erupt? So a week later, I was flying around it myself, and we experienced a great eruption just while we were there, so it was pretty exciting. But there were other clues than, you know, the earthquakes that I had. Remember, the northern slope of the peak began to undulate and to tilt towards the north.
Right.
And there were a whole series of fairly strong earthquakes, and not so many earthquakes, but there were actual eruptions. And the big one was on May 18th. That first quake was March the 20th, and then the 27th of March is when the interview with the television station, that was the day of the first actual eruption, which was more of a steam eruption, but it was pretty impressive. Then followed by some real ash eruptions that some were really much higher, and the steam and ash would go up to 40,000, 50,000 feet. But the big blast on May 18th was triggered by the earthquake, about 5.2 under the peak, which caused the oversteepened mass of rock and snow to start sliding down towards the river below. And that unloaded the magma chamber underneath the volcano, and it really exploded, just like pulling the cork on champagne. And so it was the volcano that triggered the eruption, but the eruption would have occurred sooner, you know, eventually, probably within a few months, even without the strongest earthquake in the whole series.
Jim, a few days ago, I talked with an earthquake earth changes expert, and he says not to worry until these earthquakes at Yellowstone get to 4 and above. You agree with that?
Well, I would even more. 4 isn't that big, and we've had a 3.9. That's what they told me the first one was on the 27th. Now, I hope you noticed that the 27th of December was the day of the new moon.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's hard. When these things tend to occur at the time of syzygy, and that's what's coming up on the 10th of January. But I'm not looking for the Yellowstone area to be triggered by those extreme tides. But if there's an eruption in the cards during our lifetime, a big one, we'll have plenty of clues. And such as I just mentioned, and haven't seen those yet.
So at this point, not to worry.
Just be concerned, and I think that's the status of most of the scientists that have looked at it. There was somebody on came up with his own little website and actually suggested that now's the time for everybody to evacuate within 200 miles of Yellowstone. That's way, way out of reason. And no one should pay any attention to that.
If it does go, okay, if it does go, how much damage is there here?
Well, we know that 642,000 years ago, when the big blow, well, it darkened the skies all across the eastern part of the United States, because mostly the prevailing winds are going west to east, and so that would be the worst area. And, I was just down in New Zealand, and it was interesting that Lake Taupo is also a giant caldera. And they say that earthquake and huge eruption blew out an area about 30 miles across, and definitely created like a nuclear window. It was a volcanic winter, because the steam and ash and water vapor and gases that spread around the Earth prevented a lot of the sun's energy from getting to the Earth, and we had a very cold time. And this was only about the 20,000 years ago. And that lake is just sensational to see that from above, as we saw it from this scenic area. It was about like my first view of Lake Tahoe. Now, Tahoe is not a caldera, although some people sort of thought so. But Lake Taupo definitely is, and that's where the Rotorua geothermal plant is. Yeah, the wonderful geysers and hot springs and everything. And nearby is the Wairaki geothermal plant making lots of electricity. So, you know, we have our own geothermal plant, only about 30 miles from where I'm living here in the Valley of the Moon. And that's the geysers geothermal field. And they're producing enough electricity to keep San Francisco lit up.
Explain this now. I've looked at some pictures of the Yellowstone caldera, and you know you've got the lake there. You've got Old Faithful over to the left of it. When it blows, how deep is the hole, and then how did it get filled up again to the point where it is today?
Well, it goes right down to the magma chamber, and that's liquid magma that feeds volcanoes, and they're isolated. It's not a whole mass of molten rock underneath the earth. It's individual pockets that may be tens of miles across, but then when there's weakness up above, the pressures cause the magma to come up through the surface and becomes volcanic lava. But if it's held down and the rock is too strong to it didn't have that many little fissures. The pressures can build up until you get a giant explosion, and it takes hundreds of cubic miles of material and throws it up into the air, and there's quite a hole that's left. But the magma comes up and fills
and hardens.
Yes, and a lot of it falls back. Debris falls back into the area. And then, of course, a lot of erosion, and sometimes it's as high enough there'd be a glaciation that brings material down and helps to fill the lake. And but Lake Taupo is the largest lake in Australia or New Zealand, and it's quite a tourist area, especially around Christmas time when we were there. It's a gorgeous area. You don't worry much about the volcanism. But there are several active volcanoes just in this neighborhood.
Is it safe to say that volcanoes are necessary for the planet, almost as if they're overflow valves?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. We know that we're not the only astronomical body that has volcanism.
If we didn't have volcanoes, would the planet blow up?
No. Well, it would just be slowly chill without volcanoes. Mm-hmm. Now we know that the moon used to have active volcanoes, and it doesn't anymore. There are, most of the craters you see there are strictly impacts, and from meteors, and most of that time of abundant meteors in the raining in on the moon, that time is gone. And the Earth was all pockmarked like that, too. But the normal erosion and sedimentation has filled them in.
Richard Hoagland sent me an email today, and he said that he has heard that the USGS is curtailing its reporting on the earthquake swarms from Yellowstone. Is that true? Have you heard that?
I'd hate to hear something like that. I know a couple of years ago there was an official announcement that the lake, Yellowstone Lake, the bottom of it was 100 feet higher than the last time they had seen it.
Mm-hmm. And that's right by the caldera, right? It's right on.
Yes, yes. And they said, well, this was in the winter time, and they said, well, it's interesting, and we'll be studying it more in the summertime, when it's easier to get to. Well, that's ridiculous. If it was 100 feet higher, I'd like to know compared to what, 150 years ago or 30 years ago? And was that really a good measurement? And were they talking about 100 centimeters or millimeters? So I felt that they weren't telling us enough at the time. That did cause suspicions.
Would it surprise you if they had some kind of embargo here?
It really would, because there are a lot of people living there, and they can only conceal so much.
Yeah, there's a need to know here.
Yeah, there really is. Now, I think another thing to look at is to see what the animals are doing.
I was just going to ask you that. Yes. What's happening? Do we know?
No, I haven't. Well, there were some scattered reports of, it was a moose, I think, came on the highway. And I would like to know what the bison herds are doing. Are the wolves leaving the area? Because that certainly happened back in 1902 down when the island of Martinique and Pele erupted.
But you want to see it in a herd, though, you know, a moose on a road, isolated case, right?
Exactly. There has to be a pattern. Well, like in China, when those thousands of toads appeared in the streets of the city.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, well, that was just a normal event. Well, they couldn't tell us when it ever happened before. And I don't want any expert to tell us that this is just routine in Yellowstone. This is not routine.
This is weird.
But 1999, there was a swarm of about 600 quakes, and there's been at least 20 eruptions. And even if there's an eruption, the odds are very high that it would be under control, you know, not even as big as Mount St. Helens, just a minor release. There's no reason to think that a huge super volcanic eruption is due.
But if a volcano like this goes, a caldera, that area, like where the lake is and stuff, will it be gone, obliterated?
Oh, yes, sure. It all turns to steam.
And that's what I thought.
Sure. It would be truly catastrophic. Now, it's interesting that Lake Taupo is considered to be about equivalent to the 642,000-year caldera formation there at Yellowstone.
This is the one in New Zealand?
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So here, my wife and I went by Yellowstone in 2002. That's my fourth trip there, my first one for my wife, and I noticed that there seemed to be an excessive amount of H2S and SO2 gases along the eastern shore of Yellowstone. Certainly, you could see bubbling off in the water, and that was more than I'd seen in the previous trips. Also, we know that the Norris Basin has been closed down to tourist traffic. And it was a wonderful display of hot springs and all.
Why is that? Too hot?
The ground got so hot that it was
melting the
soles of shoes and the wooden pathways that they had constructed. So I don't think that's been opened to the public. So anyway, I think that we should be concerned, but not overly, certainly not panicked.
What's new? Well, go ahead, Jim. I'm sorry.
Well, that's it. We have to keep it under control. I know that when Mammoth Lake also had a huge caldera about 600,000 years ago, see, on the same time frame as for Yellowstone. And back in 1980, when there were three 6-magnitude quakes and a bunch of smaller ones. There was quite a swarm there. And there was an increased heat flow. And there actually was a warning out that it wasn't just situation normal, that people should be aware that things are increasingly suggesting there might be a volcanic eruption. And by golly, people began to lose their investments up there, and the tourist industry went down. And there were tremendous complaints to the USGS, and they had to kind of revise their public concerns. But they did suggest that they have a second emergency exit from Mammoth Lakes.
Jim, give us your website, sir, and that newsletter address.
Yes. Well, it's SYZYGYJOB.com, and that's been around since '97, and I've had trouble getting my webmaster to keep me updated. So my home page is a couple of months out of date. But
yeah, as a matter of fact, I was going to tell you that.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I'm quite aware of that, and
get your address out real fast.
I had a new webmaster all ready to go, and he lost his business. But anyway, go to the forum on my website.
I'll tell you what, we'll get the address out when we come right back, Jim, and then we'll take phone calls as well. On our next Coast to Coast program, Lynn Marzulli joins us. author and researcher. We're going to be talking about his latest research around various UFO phenomena happening around the globe. When we come back, phone calls with Jim Berkland on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Jim, now let's get your address out before we take calls.
It's easy. It's P.O. Box 1926 in Glen Ellen, California. Two words, G-L-E-N-E-L-L-E-N. And the zip code is 95442. And if they write that address, they can get one of two things. Put in a business-sized self-addressed envelope and a couple of dollars, and I'll send them my latest Syzygy newsletter, which I've been putting out monthly now for 229 consecutive months since the earthquake in 1989 in the Bay Area. I've been successfully predicting 75% of the quakes that I've called for since 1974. And that newsletter keeps people up to date. Also, the book written about me by Cal Ori called The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, Jim Berkland, Maverick Geologist, is available through Amazon, and it's like $16.95 plus postage there, or you can get it $16.95 at a bookstore. And if they want to send it to a request to me, I'll send them a signed copy, postage free, for $20. And
explain your method again on how you do this.
Okay, well, it's multiple methods, all of which are scientifically oriented and based on visible phenomena. And the first thing is the maximum tidal force from the sun and moon. The moon has more than two times the effect on our tides that the sun has because it's so much closer and just whipping around the Earth once a month and not going from near to far in 6 months like we do with the sun. But we are closest to the sun just a couple of days ago for the whole year, and then we're going to be closest to the moon for several months on the 10th of January, on the same day as the lining up of the sun, moon, and Earth. It's nearly close. The lineup is almost so good to give an eclipse because there will be an eclipse with the next new moon and then the following full moon. So the forces are there for tremendous stresses on the crust, and that often does trigger earthquakes. And so I'm expecting to hear about another major quake, usually around the Ring of Fire, around the Pacific, between the 8th and the 15th of this month. And most of the major quakes last year occurred under such conditions. But to predict where, other than, you know, more closely than the Ring of Fire, that's up to people who live in the seismically active areas to see what's happening there. Are you along the coast and there's a bunch of whales beaching themselves? Do you have homing pigeons getting lost? Seagulls flying many miles inland? This is what Darwin observed before a great earthquake hit Chile in 1855, I believe it was, 1835. And then Concepcion, Chile, and he said there were very few clues the quake was coming due, but except for the dogs all took to the hills and the seabirds flew miles inland. So that's a couple of clues there. If you see a change in the magnetic field, some people have seen earthquake lights.
And they feel it also. They have a hum, some people.
The P wave certainly is a roaring sound because of, but it's there with the quake itself. Before the World Series quake in 89, there were people that lived in the neighborhood that said they heard deep booming noises underground. And I had another report that a 6.2 quake south of San Jose was also preceded by booming noises that sounded to this former miner like a dynamite blast deep down in the mining areas of Idaho where he had worked. So I'm convinced that those are real phenomena, not just old wives' tales. And I use the when dogs and cats run away from your home, as they did at our home before a 5.9 quake, and then they also came back, having fled somebody else's house 6 months later before another 5-magnitude quake in the Bay Area. That made me convinced that this Argentinian physicist was correct when he suggested that the lost and found column could be used as an objective measure of how many frightened animals there were. So I have all the records now since 1979 of missing pets in the L.A. Times and the San Francisco Chronicle and then the San Jose Mercury. So it's not just another old wives' tale that really works.
You're one of the best, Jim. Let's go to the calls. Let's go to Illinois we go. Hi, Craig. You're on with Jim Berkland. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah,
hello.
Hi.
Hi, George. This is Craig the cab driver who called about the dump call a while back.
That was a while back. Go ahead, Craig.
Dr. Berkland, I have a couple questions for you.
Great.
How likely is something that the, Yellowstone caldera could produce something like the NBC miniseries 10.5?
Well,
if it goes off, you know, here's the second part. If it goes off, how much danger will we be in? And then, given the fact that Illinois is in the middle of the New Madrid Fault, how could that affect us? And I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay. There are large earthquakes have finally been accepted to be able to create other large earthquakes, that they actually can trigger them. This was scorned by the scientists until 1992, I guess, when the Landers quake of about 7.4 triggered a 6.8 at Big Bear just a few hours later. But I was always saying this, you couldn't say there was no effect, now we know there is an effect. The major concern in Illinois would be the path of the volcanic debris that would spread eastward. And, in 1815, Tambora had a huge eruption in the East Indies. And the following year was called the Year Without a Summer, 1816. And the crops failed all across Canada and U.S. and Europe. And that was because of the cloud that eventually circled the Earth. And there was a similar effect when Krakatoa went off in 1883, although the delay was a couple of years until the ash and gases spread completely around the atmosphere. So there's a lag effect. It was 1886, 87. That was one of the worst winters on record. So you can get worldwide effects from a caldera eruption. And luckily for us, they are very uncommon. And I guess that Tambora one was the greatest one in recent history, if you can say almost 200 years ago now was recent. But that was not nearly as big as what happened at New Zealand, like Taupo, or 642,000 years ago at Yellowstone.
Okay, let's go to Jeff in Ferguson, Missouri. I know you, Jeffrey. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
And one quick thing. Can I say hi to the IRC Coast to Coast chat?
Of course.
I'd like to say hi to everyone in the Sorcery Net chat in IRC. But, and my question to Mr. Berkland, it's a pleasure speaking with you. With the recent New Madrid quake, recent earthquake in the Missouri, Illinois in April, and the quakes recently, are they leading up to a possible big quake?
Well, see, you never know. A foreshock is never known to be a foreshock until after the main shock. And if it turns out the foreshock triggered a quake that was slightly less, it turns out the first one was the main shock and the second one was an aftershock. You always can identify an aftershock because you had a main shock. But a foreshock, nobody can identify because really the seismic energy and the instrument recording does not ring a bell and say this is a foreshock. You can only say based on past behavior. Now, in California, half of our damaging quakes did not have a foreshock. But half did.
And one last question, if I can.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Are there ways to determine if earthquakes are possibly man-made or natural? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yes. If we have a nuclear explosion underground like we used to do in Nevada, it would shake the ground itself, and they felt it in Las Vegas. But also it could trigger quakes of lesser energy than the main explosion. I don't know of a single case where a larger quake was triggered by a seismic energy event, although I was one day that the largest quake of the year hit Mexico on the same day as one of the larger tests in down in Frenchman's Flat in Nevada. And I thought, oh, look at that. And it turns out that the earthquake was a couple hours ahead of the timing of the nuclear blast. So I don't think the earthquake triggered the nuclear blast. Also, I was going to the University of California, Davis, in 1969, when they're about to explode a big nuclear test in the trench there in Alaska. And we were concerned at that time, and we all protested it. And it turns out that the big blast, nuclear blast, occurred near the Aleutian Trench, and there were no big quakes anywhere in the world for a couple of months. So it didn't happen. And so it's true that you can create smaller earthquakes by man's efforts, whatever you'd like, even drilling for oil has caused some smaller quakes in the Long Beach, California area. And, of course, moving water around. They're trying to get rid of the chemical warfare waste in the area of Denver back in the 60s. And it triggered a whole series of earthquakes up to 5 magnitude. And, of course, the government denied there was any relationship until they shut the pumps down and the earthquake stopped. And then when they had regenerated the pumps after a couple of days lag time, and the quake started up again. And then they all said, oh, it's perfectly logical. We thought so all the time. But little by little, we're learning more and more about earthquakes, but no two are the same. And we just have to keep eyes, ears, and minds open to identify the phenomena related to earthquakes and volcanic eruptions.
Absolutely. Let's go to Barbara in Pahrump, Nevada. Hey, Barbara, go ahead.
George and Jim, what an honor and pleasure to speak to you both.
Great.
I cannot believe I got through the first time. I've only been trying for 2 years.
You're in Art Bell country.
I am. Sure I is. Am. And, Mr. Berkland, I have been following your work for so long, and I so admire you. But my question to you is this. Since in Nevada we're not that far away from Yellowstone, if it were to blow, and given, I know the jet stream, and usually everything goes west to east and all that stuff, what type of fallout, for lack of a better word, do you think Nevada could expect?
Well, it would definitely be bad within a year. Remember, it gets up into the jet stream and goes all around the world and makes several trips. It colors our sunset,
mm-hmm.
and it could affect the communication, but definitely it affects the weather. And you would have earlier snows and colder summers, colder winters. And, you know, it would really be devastating to our crops. Of course, Nevada is not that rich in agricultural pursuits, but it would affect the whole world if you had a major caldera type super volcanic eruption.
Mm-hmm. And you don't think that anything is imminent at this point? Not
right.
For us to worry yet?
Right. Really, I'd give it, less than a 1% chance of happening within the next, year.
Okay. Okay. Well, I've been following the USGS site, and it's pretty scary to look at all those quakes up there, even though they might be minor. It's pretty scary.
Yeah. We had swarms at Mammoth Lakes.
Yeah.
With nothing following. And also there were swarms down in Mexicali, in the Salton Sea Trough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's had some volcanic eruptions in centuries ago, but none followed the swarms they've had down there and earthquakes. But there'll be a lot more clues.
Next time, let's go to Herb, Palmetto, Florida. You're up with us. Hey, Herb, go ahead.
How are you today, sir?
We're great, thanks.
Great. This is my first time calling your show and listening to your show.
Well, good. Thanks for finding us. Absolutely.
Two items. It was originally one until I heard the second to last caller. And you could consider me fortunate or unfortunate, but we went through the 50s Yellowstone earthquake, and then I lived in Denver in the mid-60s when they were pumping the water into the ground.
Interesting, yeah.
I was in high school there.
Yeah.
Just a pure fluke. I'd forgotten all about that, and my uncle worked for one of the companies who was subcontracting. But my question to your guest is this. Now, I don't recall if the quake in the 50s was in the 57 or 59 or exactly.
59.
Was it 59?
August,
I was right.
August 17th, okay. Yeah. August 17th. It was the day of the full moon, too.
Yeah, well, we were parked in a mobile home in a travel trailer in a little place backwoods there in Yellowstone.
Ooh.
And the morning of the quake, the creek we were by turned completely muddy, and we ran into an old ranger and asked him what was going on. He said he had absolutely no idea.
Whoa.
We had no knowledge of the quake whatsoever. As a matter of fact, our families thought we were there at the major epicenter because that's where we were supposed to have been.
Wow.
But we locked up. My question to your guest is just one-fold. Do you have the data from that time frame, and how does it correlate with the current phenomena?
Well, there were some small quakes, true, that were observed by the ranger there. And I understand that the birds took off from the lake, Hibgin Lake.
They could have. We weren't anywhere near there.
Oh, you weren't. Luckily,
no, we were back in the sticks.
Well, there were a lot of sticks there, and I talked to a veterinary, who with his wife they were on a like a honeymoon trip, and they were right next to Hebgen Lake and this campsite. They were really dead tired, and they pulled up, and they had the last spot, but it turned out to be so steep that they couldn't flatten out their trailer so they could spend the night, and they had to get out of there, and they pulled to the next campsite like 30 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
That campsite was engulfed with this huge landslide that dammed
up
the river.
Right, that's the one we were supposed to have been at.
Really? Well, you're a second
person
then that you're lucky to be around. Because those people are still underneath there. They haven't been able to dig them out.
Yeah. Well, like I said, my question was, is the data correlating to the same toward the same effect as then is now, or is there anything at all you could even see that looks close?
Well, all that we know, there's a book by John Reinhart called Geysers and Geothermal Energy, and there he focuses on Old Faithful, and it turns out Old Faithful slowed down its eruption cycle before that quake from around 65 minutes to about 85 minutes.
Jim, my friend, thank you for being on the program. Jim Berkland updating us on Yellowstone. For Karis Coburn, Dave Caprita, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Jesse Angelo, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.